Welcome to RTB Live Extra, a new podcast brought to you by Reasons to Believe. This week, we'll answer science faith questions we didn't get to during this week's RTB Live broadcast. If you want to catch the show live, tune in on Thursdays at 1 p.m. Pacific on the Reasons to Believe YouTube channel.
Yo Y asks, can you talk about how the physics of the universe prevents evil?
Well, the universe is constrained by four fundamental laws of physics. We got the strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force. We have gravity, and we got electromagnetism. And because of that, we have this pervasive law of decay. That's important to get physical life in the universe, but it's also crucial to restrain the expression of evil. You actually see this in Genesis 3, the moment that Adam and Eve choose to rebel against God and personally experience evil. God says, because of your decision, from now on, you're going to experience more pain. You're going to have to go through more work. And other passages say, you're going to find yourself wasting more time. And none of us enjoys extra pain, extra work, and extra time being wasted. And so that motivates us to avoid evil and pursue virtue, just so we don't go through these consequences of undoing the damage from our evil. And the process we discover, we do not have the resources we need to do what we know the laws of physics are telling us to do. And that's what motivates us to seek God's help. And God's the one that says, yeah, if you come to me, I'll help you do what you can't do for yourself. You want more of the details on that? Wrote a whole book on it, Why the Universe is the Way It Is.
Okay, and a question from Splodin. What is the consensus among the astronomer community regarding the galactic requirements to support advanced civilization? Do they agree with the RTB calculated probabilities?
Well, they agree in part. When I was an astronomer at Caltech, the pressure to be able to publish and do the research was at such a level that I had to specialize. And because of hyper-specialization, my peers would be aware of those galactic requirements that are in their area of their sub-discipline, but they may not be aware of what's going on in the other sub-disciplines. This is one reason why we at Reasons to Believe take top scholars out of academia and set them free to do the necessary interdisciplinary studies so that people can see the big picture. And many of my astronomy peers really appreciate that we do for them what they don't have time to do for themselves.
Question from Paul Keatles. How abundant is water in our galaxy, and can it exist in a different galaxial frequency so we cannot see it from an earthly mind, but exists as an environment in which Jehovah can live?
Yeah, I'm not sure where Paul's going with this question, but I can answer the first part. How abundant is water in our galaxy? It's very abundant. Water is the third most abundant molecule in the universe, right after hydrogen 2 and hydrogen 3. I mean, the universe is fundamentally soaking wet with water. And one of the unique features of our planet Earth is that it's a body the size that it is, the distance it is from its star, but instead of having the typical 5 to 50% total water content, it has only 0.03%. If we were like other planets, like planet Earth, our oceans would be so deep you would never get continents. And if you never get surface continents, you can't recycle the nutrients that makes advanced life possible. So that's one of the unique features of our planet, is just how water poor it is relative to what we expect given its features. The rest of Paul's question, I'm not sure who is going, so I think it'd be best just to let that go rather than try to guess.
Okay, next question from Mason. Why do physicists like Sean Carroll think our universe is eternal?
Well, I've met Sean Carroll. He's at Caltech. In fact, he was part of a debate I was involved in with the International Skeptic Society back in 2008. In fact, we got a video recording of that where you can hear his remarks. And he's a non-theistic physicist. He seems quite opposed to the Christian worldview. And so it's not at all surprising that he believes that the universe is eternal, that he takes the same worldview position as an old professor of mine, gee, I'm trying to think of his name, Carl Sagan. He had that same worldview that the universe is all there is or ever was or ever will be, and therefore it must have existed forever. And so Sean Carroll has developed an eternity theorem for the universe. However, it requires significant speculation about events that take place in the first 10 to the minus 43 seconds of the existence of the universe. That's a part of the time frame of the universe that we do not yet have tools to investigate. So he basically speculates that radically different physics occurs there, and he comes up with this eternal universe theorem. However, other physicists who take a different worldview than Sean have actually come up with models of the universe in that same era, where they basically say it's just what we see and all the other evidence we can measure. The universe has been around for a finite time only. And I would add, this is something I made a point of in The Creator and the Cosmos, fourth edition, where I actually comment on Sean Carroll's work, making the point that if you look at all the experimental and observational evidence, 100% of it supports the idea, the concept that the universe has been around for a finite time, that matter, energy, space, and time were created by a causal agent beyond matter, energy, space, and time. Atheists like Sean Carroll are forced to go to things that we can't measure, that we can't observe, can't do experiments on. That's why I put a chapter in The Creator and the Cosmos, how to respond to non-empirical arguments for atheism.
Okay, question from Kevin. What is time as a scientist term and as a biblical term, and are they the same?
Well, it's a good question from Kevin. Because we human beings are constrained within a single dimension of time that can't be stopped or reversed, it's not possible for us to get outside of that single dimension of time and actually see the whole scope of it and come up with a comprehensive definition. We're forced to develop definitions that work within what we can see and experience. But those definitions that scientists use, namely that effects come after the causes, not before, we see that entropy runs in one direction where decay increases. This is consistent with what the Bible tells us about time. I particularly recommend what you see in the book of Ecclesiastes.
Yo asks, how does dark energy cause the universe to expand, and why does it get stronger with time?
Well, dark energy is the energy that's embedded in the space surface of the universe. It exists everywhere in the space surface of the universe. And the way dark energy operates, as the universe expands, the surface of the universe gets progressively bigger and bigger. As it gets bigger and bigger, dark energy becomes progressively more and more powerful in its capacity to accelerate the expansion of the universe. Gravity works to slow down the cosmic expansion. Dark energy works to accelerate the cosmic expansion. But now that the universe has expanded as much as it is, gravity has become weaker in its capacity to slow down the expansion. Dark energy has become stronger. For the past 7 billion years, the universe has been expanding at a progressively more and more rapid rate. This will continue, but there'll come a time when the universe will expand so rapidly they won't be able to see the sun, but that's a long ways off.
Question from Douglas McComb. What percentage of space would you say contains no matter at all, dark or otherwise?
Well, interesting question. I mean, for example, there's about one proton for every cubic meter of space. So in that sense, the universe, as you average it out, is a mostly empty space, very little matter in it. But the matter is fairly pervasive. I mean, there's really no big region of the universe you can go to that's totally devoid of dark matter and electrons, protons, and neutrons. But yeah, the universe is very close to a vacuum. There's just not that much there once you get outside of stars existing in the universe.
Okay. Next question. Does the earth and moon forming theory that matches the Bible have a name? I could not find info or models that matches your presentation on the order of creation days in the Bible.
Okay, a couple of questions there. The Bible really doesn't address when the how the moon formed or when it formed. It does say that mentions the great lights on creation day 4. So it's certainly telling us the moon was around at that time. The earth is mentioned in Genesis 1:2, so it's there even before the 6 days of creation. Incidentally, when it says the heavens and the earth in Genesis 1:1, that's a reference to the entire universe. The earth would not have to exist, according to the Bible, at the beginning. So the name that astronomers have for the moon-forming event is simply that. They call it the moon-forming event. They've got a fairly decent understanding of how the moon formed. It was a result of another planet, a little smaller than the Earth, merging with the Earth. And the last part of his question, how come he can't find an order of events for the biblical creation events is similar to what we have here, Reasons to Believe? It's not unique to us. I know several authors that have published commentaries on Genesis 1, where they describe an order of creation events very similar to what we offer at Reasons to Believe. Matter of fact, some of them predate us all the way back to Isaac Newton. He didn't have as much detail as we have, but what he had was consistent with what we have. I think it was Peter Stoner who came up with an order quite similar to ours. And of course, you got people like Robert Newman. And probably the most recent would be, the mathematician out of Britain. Trying to think of his name. He wrote a book on the 7 days of creation. His view is quite similar to ours as well.
Okay, question from Paul. How do the stars of the galaxy communicate with each other to all maintain their formation?
Well, the stars in our galaxy gravitationally interact with one another. And that is the predominant way they engage one another, is through their mutual gravitational interaction. So for example, we do have a slight gravitational interaction with the nearest star, Alpha Centauri. It's not enough, however, to disturb the orbits of the planets because it is 4.25 light years away. Likewise, we got the Andromeda Galaxy, 2.5 million light years away. It does gravitationally interact with our galaxy, and it's such that about 5 billion years from now, those two galaxies will merge.
Another question, how long has our solar system been in the local area?
How long has our solar system been in the local area? I think he's referring to the local area of our local arm and in our galaxy. Stars revolve around the center of the galaxy at a different rate than the spiral structure, except when you're at the co-rotation distance. As I mentioned in the talk, the solar system is just inside the co-rotation distance, so it pretty well keeps pace with the spiral arm structure, but not exactly. So we cross spiral arms about once every billion years. So if you're talking about being in the area say out to about 300 light years. We've been there for a good billion years, but beyond that, by the way, stars do go past us. Astronomers estimate that about 5 to 15 million years ago, an association of supermassive stars passed by our solar system, and actually several of those stars went supernova, and when they went supernova, they blew out a huge bubble. And right now, the sun is almost dead center in that bubble. That's actually a good thing because it's a bubble of a very diffuse gas. So an area of very low matter density, thanks to this pass-by of supergiant stars 5 to 15 million years ago.
Okay, another question from Splodin. Has anyone ever detected and or experimented on the human spirit?
Well, given that the human spirit, at least that was defined in the Bible and those of us who are Christians, it's not in the physical realm. It's not part of the physics and chemistry of the universe. And therefore, it's not possible to build a physical instrument that can directly measure the operation of the spirit. On the other hand, we can see the consequences of the operation of the spirit. I mean, free will, for example, is very difficult to explain unless there's some non-physical component to us human beings. Likewise, the fact that humans seem unique amongst all life on planet Earth and that we're concerned about what happens after we die. You know, we alone ask the God question, is there something outside the physics and chemistry of the universe? The Bible has an interesting statement in Ecclesiastes 3, where it says eternity is written on the heart of every human being, namely that God has imposed upon our spirit the knowledge that we do exist beyond our physical life. A lot of people will argue against that, but the very fact that they argue against that means that there's something beyond the physical, because the non-human animals don't behave that way. The non-human animals seem to have no concern. Or as the Bible puts it, God created birds and mammals to serve and please a higher species. He created us human beings to serve and please a higher being, a being beyond the physics of the universe.
We have two questions that are related. First one is from Andy and Sandra McPhillips. It says, RTB published in peer-reviewed scientific magazines. And the second question from another viewer asks, Dr. Ross, have you or Dr. Rana had any significant expert response to your book, Origins of Life?
Well, our scholars at Reasons to Believe do publish in peer-reviewed scientific journals, not frequently. After all, we've left academia and our research to basically do interdisciplinary studies on how the different scientific disciplines and the books of the Bible integrate together. And so on rare occasions, we'll publish in a peer-reviewed scientific journal, but most of the time, we're focusing on publishing articles for scientists and non-scientists alike, and also books. However, we do submit our more serious books and articles to peer review from Christian and non-Christian experts alike. So for example, every book on science is published by Reasons to Believe, goes out for external peer review. And we're very grateful for that, because often when we do that, we get some very good suggestions on how we can either correct or improve the content of the books that we're bringing out. But both Fuzz and I have published in the peer-reviewed scientific journals. It's just that we're not putting out 40 or 50 papers a year, such as what's common when you're in full-time research mode, like I was when I was at Caltech. Okay, the second part of that question was, what about our book, Origins of Life? Interestingly, we got a phone call after we published our book, Origins of Life, and it was from Dr. David Deamer, one of the world's top Origin of Life researchers. And you know, we heard him speak at the Origins of Life research conferences that we attended. And he basically said, do I have your permission to write a review of your book? And he says, you know, I'm not like you, I'm an atheist, so I'm going to be critical. Are you okay with that? And we said, we can only benefit from your critique. I mean, you're a top scholar in this discipline. Please critique our book, and you know, we'll pay attention to your critique because we're committed to put out future editions. And so you can read David Deamer's critique of Origins of Life. It is published in Origins of Life and Evolution of the Biosphere. If you put our names in with Dr. Deamer, that should pop right up, and you'll be able to read that review for yourself. And he didn't agree with our theology, but he did agree that we did a really good job doing an interdisciplinary survey of the status of Origin of Life research.
Okay, next question from Ken Wolgemuth, ministry friend. I understand hydrogen and helium formed from the moment of creation. Asking the question on Google indicated 380,000 years passed before atoms formed. Did it take that long?
Good question from Ken. The hydrogen and helium, the universe begins with only one element, hydrogen. In less than 4 minutes after the Big Bang creation event, a quarter of that hydrogen is fused into helium through nuclear fusion. But after that, the hydrogen and helium are ionized. In other words, there's no electrons associated with them. And so not until 380,000 years after the cosmic creation event does the universe become cool enough where electrons can now become attached to the nuclei of hydrogen and helium. So at that point, atoms begin to form, and hydrogen is able to bond with another hydrogen and form hydrogen too. And it takes millions of years thereafter before the first stars are able to form. And when the first stars form, they're able to take that primordial hydrogen and helium, and in the nuclear furnaces of the stars, fuse that hydrogen to helium into heavier elements. So everything beyond hydrogen and helium and just a tiny smattering of a lithium comes from the furnaces of stars. So in that sense, we're all stardust. We're all a product of what stars have been spewing out into interspace ever since stars first formed.
Another question from Yo. Revelation states that Jesus will reign 1,000 years on earth. In your opinion, why would he do this instead of ushering right into a new universe?
Well, let me make it clear that not all Christians agree that Jesus is going to physically reign here on planet Earth for 1,000 years. Christians who take a millennial perspective on their interpretation of what you see in the book of Revelation do believe that Jesus will physically reign here on Earth for 1,000 years. But amillennialists do not take that position. And incidentally, we have people on staff here at Reasons to Believe on both sides of this issue. So I just want to make it clear there are different Christian perspectives on this. I myself am premillennial. I do believe Jesus will reign for 1,000 years on this physical earth. And as I read the passages in the Old and New Testament that are relevant to this, it seems to me that what Jesus is doing during that 1,000 years is removing every possible excuse for why we humans sin, except the real reason. I mean, he locks up Satan for the 1,000 years. He eliminates carnivorous activity, because some people think that's the reason why we sin. He makes sure that we've got a perfect government. You can't blame the government. And we got everybody who's submitted to Christ. It basically takes away all of our excuses. The economy is perfect. Every excuse except the one that is real, the one in Jeremiah 17, 9 and 10. Jeremiah 17, 9 and 10, we sin because our human hearts are wicked beyond what we can imagine. And except for the grace of God, all of us would go our own way and pursue a path of evil and depart from virtue. But there's a loving God that's prepared to do for us what we can't do for ourselves. That's the heart of the Christian message, that, you know, good works is not going to do it. There's no way anyone can do sufficient good works to really eliminate the propensity towards evil in your life. But if you go to God, he says, if you come to me, I will send my Holy Spirit and I'll do for you what you can't do for yourself, thanks to the work of the creator of the universe that he did on the cross 2,000 years ago.
Okay, our last question was asked in different ways by many viewers, but this question comes from Krishnam. What is the possibility of discovering intelligent life outside of Earth?
Well, if you mean non-physical intelligent life, that possibility is extremely high, because the Bible tells us that God created two distinct species of intelligent life: human beings that are constrained by the physics of the universe, and angels that are not. And we've written a book, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, talking about the abundant evidence we have, including physical evidence, that angels are real beings that God created. But it's possible that Krishnam's referring to the possibility of us discovering intelligent life that, like us, is constrained by the physics of the universe. And there's nothing in the Bible that says that God did not create another intelligent physical species of life somewhere else in the universe. The Bible is silent on that issue. The only biblical constraint is what you see in Hebrews 9 and 10, that Jesus Christ, the creator of the universe, died one time, one place, for all sinners, which would seem to imply that intelligent life that is trapped in sin and in need of redemption is only living here on planet Earth. But that doesn't eliminate the possibility that God created dolphins on another planet or intelligent beings that are not in need of redemption. But I can tell you as an astronomer, everywhere we look in the universe, we see conditions that are hostile for the existence of advanced life. The only place we've been able to find that's at all habitable for advanced life is our own planet Earth. To put this in context, we've found 4,100 planets that exist beyond our solar system. And we now know that there are 13 distinct habitable zones, distinct from the liquid water habitable zone. And of all the planets we've discovered, only one planet simultaneously exists in all three of those habitable zones. It's the same planet that simultaneously exists in all 11 planetary habitable zones. And I'll leave it to the listeners of this podcast to try to determine which planet that is.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.